Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm David Bowes, your host. In this episode, we speak with the editor of the new book, The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society, the associate director of the Center for Science and Culture, Dr. John G. West. In this podcast, I'll talk with Dr. West about C.S. Lewis's views on science, how he feared science could lead to coercion, and what impact cultural or psychological changes in man's worldview have on the scientific community. Many people know C.S. Lewis as the creative inspiration for the Narnia movies and the author of the classic children's books, but what else do they need to know about C.S. Lewis and why is he relevant to everybody?
Well, C.S. Lewis was also this Christian apologist, sold more than 200 million copies of his works. But what I think really going to be intriguing to people is how much Lewis was interested in science, and particularly its impact on society and impact on freedom, or sometimes actually as a counter to human freedom.
So Lewis's views on science are important because, one, he's C.S. Lewis and he had such a cultural impact on the country. And two,
because he was really prophetic. Although he was writing in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, he really predicted and saw a lot of the things that are coming to pass right now.
In chapter one in your book, The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society, you write, because you wrote that particular chapter, you write that science can be used as a trump card, quote, not to persuade people, but to silence them. What do you mean by that?
Well, we see that all the time right now. Let's take some practical examples. For example, in the global warming debate, and I should make clear, I really don't have clear views of myself on that, but when you have scientists like James Lovelock in Britain making claims that we should suspend democracy for a while, or in our own country, when you have the Obama administration, when they argue about forcing religious groups to either offer contraceptives against their conscience or even abortion drugs, how is that sold? Well, our Secretary of Health and Human Services said, well, this is good science. Science says it's good. Therefore, the implication is that trumps your religious liberty, that trumps your values, that trumps everything else. And I think this was one of the things that Lewis was really concerned about, what might be called scientism, or actually near the end of his life, he talked about scientocracy, this idea of ruling in the name of science, that decides all questions.
Even now, I think a lot of people forget that there are other forms of knowledge that are not necessarily scientific, but forms of knowledge that are worth having.
True. And even more so than that, science itself presupposes those other forms of knowledge. As Lewis pointed out, the basic rules of logic on which science is based, science itself doesn't create. And so science should be accountable to those rules of logic, just like other disciplines.
You also wrote in the same chapter that scientific advancements have led some toward a revival of the idea of eugenics under the new banners of transhumanism and reprogenetics, a term coined by Princeton University biologist Lee Silver. What do these terms mean, and how might they impact science and culture?
Yeah, this is really fascinating because C.S. Lewis, in a book called The Abolition of Man, warned about the efforts to breed a master race, a superhuman race using the principles of Darwinian biology. And what you see here, transhumanism, this is coming out of scholars from Oxford, Lewis's old stomping grounds and elsewhere, who again are saying that we're going to be left behind in evolutionary terms and die out if we don't take our evolution in hand and sort of breed a master race. And so that argument is very similar to what you mentioned, the eugenics movement of the early part of the 20th century, which Lewis was actually confronting in not only Germany, but also in his homeland of England.
The eugenics movement was basically crushed as a movement because of the stain of Nazism. Is there any stain on this new movement, or is it enjoying an untouchable status because it's surrounded by the new cultural supreme, which is science?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I would like to think that the stain of Nazism is still with us, and it is to a degree, but it's gotten a lot less. And so you're right, whereas 20 or 30 years ago, people would have said, this sounds like what they did in Germany, and they would have been right. Today, people think of that less often. And in fact, today, you've almost even seen a rewriting of the history of eugenics, where some people say, well, you know, that was just pseudoscience of the time. Cranks proposed it. Now we're a lot smarter. Now it's come from the sciences. Well, actually, if you look at the first eugenics movement, it was promoted by the leading evolutionary biologists at Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Columbia. They were actually the elite scientists of their time. And so, although in retrospect, we might want to think that they're cranks, for their time, they weren't. And so, but you're right. I think a lot of people are not thinking about the history, the experience that we have gone through. And they think we're immune to that. But they have such a stick figure view of, say, Nazi Germany. Germany, at the time that it did the horrific things it did, was known as the height of human culture in music, in the sciences in particular, in philosophy, in the social sciences. People looked to this. And so to say that we're more sophisticated or that, you know, we're the height of culture, really, the historical experience doesn't give you an immunity from doing horrible things.
In what other ways, if any, do you foresee that science could lead to coercion, intentionally or unintentionally?
Well, again, if science is viewed, or claims made in the name of science, are viewed as the absolute trump card in public policy, then this becomes really the excuse of choice to limit human freedoms. And we're seeing that in such otherwise mundane things as New York City going on about whether people can have sugary drinks and to actually pass regulations about that. Now, I don't allow my kids to drink everything under the sun, and we should be concerned about overconsumption of that. On the other hand, if you look at how this is being sold, there was a Harvard evolutionary biologist, Daniel Lieberman, who wrote, well, we have to do this. We have to be coercive because evolution has basically bred us to need coercion. Well, once you go down that path, where does it end? And so I think that we're increasingly seeing science used as a justification for the limits of our human freedom. Also, actually, in some privacy things of people being tracked and talk about internet privacy that a lot of people on both left and right have legitimate concerns about. Basically, the idea is, well, the science allows us to do it, therefore we have to do it. And this is the sort of scientocracy type thinking that Lewis was so fearful of, legitimately so.
In Chapter 3 in C.S. Lewis on Science as a Threat to Freedom, Edward Larson writes that Lewis believed that the reductionist tendency of modern science undermined moral reasoning. What does he mean by reductionist tendency, and how might that undermine moral reasoning?
Yeah, basically, people might consider it the abuse excuse or the, you know, my genes made me do it excuse, that no matter, you know, what you do, you're not accountable for it because really human accountability doesn't exist in the scientific materialist mindset. We're just blind matter in motion, the product completely of blind material forces. Now, of course, we are impacted by matter in motion. We are impacted by our environment. No one denies it. No one has ever denied that, even before the rise of modern science. But what they have insisted is that human beings actually can make real choices. And this scientific materialist mindset is very reductionist in that it basically says your choices aren't real. They're just the product of your brain chemistry or what happens to be going on in your bloodstream or what you ate, and your blood sugar levels. And so it really, how can you have moral reasoning there when you're actually denying that we're moral agents?
We actually have a movement toward what you're describing here in terms of our criminal justice system, with people talking about sexual predators and others as products of some kind of an illness or some kind of a physical or chemical deformity, so that they're not responsible for their actions. They need quote-unquote treatment, which kind of begs the question, why do you have them in jail if they're not responsible for their actions?
Lewis actually was very prescient in thinking about that. He wrote an essay once called The Humanitarian Theory of Punishment, where he talks precisely about treating all evil doing as simply an illness, and basically as a way of saying that people aren't accountable for their actions. And he said, you know, this is often sold as being kind and compassionate, but he pointed out, and it's really quite true, that if you actually think it's equivalent to having cancer or something, well, think of what we allow doctors to do to us to cure us from disease. There are sorts of things that you never allow in a humane society a police department to do. They cut us open. They do all sorts of things in the name of saving us, legitimately so. So Lewis pointed out that if you really take that medical model for criminal justice, not only are you denying people's accountability as created in the image of God, you actually end up treating them in a far more inhumane way. And in fact, there were lots of experiments on prisoners during the time that Lewis lived. And so he saw this coming.
I'm speaking with Dr. John West. He has edited and co-written the book, The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society. In Chapter 3, Lewis is quoted commenting on his book, That Hideous Strength, saying, "Under modern conditions, any effective invitation to hell will certainly appear in the guise of scientific planning, as Hitler's regime in fact did." What do you believe Lewis meant by that?
He was really pointing out there's this utopian tendency among human beings to try to claim that they can create heaven on earth. And you certainly saw it during his lifetime with the Marxists, and you saw it with National Socialism in Germany. And so he said science is almost our new God. You know, it says that it offers, well, we will solve all your problems. You know, we'll come up with a magic pill that will mean that you don't have to actually train yourself ethically or things, because the pill will do it for you. And you don't have to pay attention to character, or you don't have to pay attention to your choices. We can eliminate all human problems and create sort of a utopia. And so he thought, you know, that though, in order to do that, you have to give up your freedoms, because you're basically saying, well, there are these experts who know a lot more than I do, and I have to place myself in their hands and let them reshape society.
The smartest should rule.
Yeah, really. Lewis also used the term technocracy, the idea that experts, rule by the experts, or tyranny of the experts, mm-hmm. was really what he was concerned about. Because he pointed out that, and he wasn't against expertise, and neither am I, and certainly not against the role of science legitimately in public policy, but what he was pointing out is science doesn't answer all questions. So as he points out, public policy is about competing priorities. Global warming is a good example. And again, my own feelings about what caused it and I don't have a clear view on that. But what I will say is that someone who says, well, this is what the science says about global warming, therefore you have to put a million people out of work.
Right.
Well, as Lewis pointed out, well, that's not just a scientific question. And you have competing goods, human flourishing, and people have a right to feed their families, and then biodiversity. I mean, you have all sorts of competing goods. And a scientist alone doesn't have the right to say which of those competing goods is most important or which is too costly to other values that we have to actually impose.
There's a chapter on the medieval mind, C.S. Lewis, Science and the Medieval Mind. In it, Jake Atkins writes about Lewis's respect for the medieval mind. I'm sure people listening, hearing about C.S. Lewis and science, are asking, why would C.S. Lewis's view on the medieval mind be important? And what kinds of myths about the medieval mind or that worldview does Lewis clarify for the modern reader? And how does he make our past, the minds of our ancestors, so to speak, in these different ages, why are they important to reconsider today?
Over the past 100 years, we've basically been sold a narrative about faith and science that says something like this. Before Darwin, before his followers, it was an age of superstition, and particularly religion in the form of Christianity just tried to stop science, tried to stop Galileo. If Columbus had followed what the Christians thought, he would have thought that he was going over the cliff of the earth because everyone thought it was flat. I mean, on and on and on. Lewis knew, as a medieval and Renaissance scholar, that this was poppycock. And in fact, it was a very tendentious propagandistic narrative coming out of the 19th century materialists to try to belittle what, in fact, the true story was, which is that the Judeo-Christian tradition in the Middle Ages and after helped, if anything, inspire a modern science. As Lewis pointed out in one of his books, it was because people thought there was a lawgiver in the universe, that they thought they could look for laws and regularities in nature. And that was different than many other cultures. And that was a real help to science. And so a lot of these big things, and Lewis was, now many secular historians have pointed this out, but Lewis was one of the earlier people to really bring out in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance just how sophisticated they were and how the rudiments of modern science and the scientific method really date back to the Middle Ages. And so he exploded things like the flat earth myth, the idea that educated people several centuries ago thought the earth was flat, or that the earth was somehow so the center of the universe that, they didn't understand that we lived in a huge, universe. And he said, this is just wrong. And because he was a scholar in that, he cited primary sources, and he was an early trailblazer to more modern historians who have revisited that.
And yet it's become, our culture is saturated by people who are eager to get us to believe this, and it's considered accepted as true in newscasts even today, that religion stifles science.
Yes.
And so what you're pointing out is Lewis wanted people to know their history so that they would understand that religion has inspired science.
That's right, or at least was very favorable to the conditions of it, and in key respects did actually help inspire some things. Lewis definitely did want people to know that.
And the conclusion of that chapter, it concludes by examining Lewis's argument that scientific worldviews change in large part due to cultural or psychological changes in man's worldview. What does Lewis mean by that? Instead of new scientific evidence changing the scientific worldview, these cultural and psychological changes, and what evidence does he have for that theory?
The very last book that Lewis wrote, it was published after his death, was called The Discarded Image. And on the surface, it's an explication of the medieval worldview. But one of the key themes is the nature of science, the nature of scientific revolutions. And one of Lewis's key points throughout that book, but especially in the epilogue to it, is that scientists are just as human as anyone else, and that new scientific theories often grow out of not just because of the evidence so much, but because of what people are expecting to see. And he actually applied this specifically to the Darwinian revolution in biology. He said, the Darwinian revolution in biology wasn't because of all this new array of facts. It was basically because people had a worldview that they were expecting a developing universe that could develop itself because of a lot of other cultural developments. And he actually argued that if Darwin didn't invent this theory, someone else would have because of the overall cultural worldview. And he made something like a very insightful point, which was nature gives answers to the questions we ask her. So he wasn't actually saying that these new scientific theories were against all the evidence necessarily, but he points out that we get the answers, to the questions that we ask. And so if we're blinded, in the case of, say, biology, if we only assume that material impersonal processes are the only things that could do anything, we'll only ask certain forms of questions. Whereas if we have a different view, we might ask other questions that would then lead us to different answers. And in fact, again, modern biology, a great example of this is the whole myth of junk DNA. For decades, Darwinian biologists said Darwinian evolution is a blind, purposeless process. We should expect lots of mistakes along the way, and so that the DNA should just accumulate these things as long as it doesn't destroy the organism. And so that's why they thought that more than 90% of our DNA, which was non-coding for protein DNA, was non-functional garbage junk, sort of leftover garbage from the Darwinian process. Well, they basically were starting from an assumption, a lack of knowledge. The science actually didn't show that. They didn't actually know what the stuff did. They just assumed based on this sort of worldview. And lo and behold, what have we found out just in the last few years? In fact, just in the last 5 years, this non-coding DNA that was supposed to be junk and garbage turns out to be tremendously functional. In fact, it may even be more important in some respects than the protein-coding DNA because it may help regulate what that does. And so this is a prime example of that you're blinded by the sorts of questions you ask of nature.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast of ID the Future concerning the new book, The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society. For more information and an exciting video about C.S. Lewis, go to csluisweb.com.